The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Every year about this time, we get an update on Social Security's finances. What is today's telling us?
Once again, Social Security is paying out more in benefits than it's collecting in payroll taxes and interest. What we learned today is that the trust fund that helps to make up the difference is projected to run out of cash in about 10 years, or a year earlier than had been projected. And if that happens, everyone who relies on Social Security would automatically have their benefits cut by about 23%. So this is our annual wake-up call that something's got to be done to shore up this popular program. That means raising taxes, cutting benefits, or some combination of the two.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That's not good news, huh? Good afternoon. It's good to be back here with you today. Let's talk about your future. Let's talk about Social Security. You just heard in that news clip there that on Friday, the Social Security Administration issued a new report on the health of the trust funds. And unfortunately, the news was not good. Last year, they projected that the funds would be depleted by the year 2034. This year, the report shows that it's going to happen 2033, I believe, is a year, 10 years from now. It's not that far. I don't know whether you're receiving your Social Security right now, or you're on the eve of receiving it, or you've been paying into it for a while. You want to know if you're going to get it. My perspective, we'll speak in just a moment to an expert here on this issue. They'll find a way to make sure Social Security is there for you. A lot of the press releases that have come from the department, according to their press releases, the combined asset reserves of the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund is projected to become depleted. I think 2034 is the number. Now they're saying 2033. But after that, the Old Age Fund is going to pay out 77% of the benefits. But the Disability Fund will still be able to pay out fully, and it's supposed to be fully funded for the next 75 years. So here are some of the interesting facts they told Congress in the report. I'll share these with you quickly, and then Vonda Ventil will be stopping by. We'll get her perspective on it. You can join me, too. If you got a question, feel free to dial in. It's 888-914-9149. So a couple of quick facts for you. The total annual cost of the program is projected to exceed the total annual income this year and remain higher throughout the 75-year projection period. It was 2 years ago that the total cost began to be higher than the total income. And one other thing, Social Security costs, well, they've exceeded its non-interest income although since 2010. That means that up until about 13 years ago, Social Security could pay benefits on the interest that they were getting on the investment alone. Then they had to start using the principal to pay out. And that's not a good thing. So bottom line is, what's it mean, right? What's it mean for you? When will these changes take place? And what's the truth behind the news that's coming out? Vonda Ventil joins me. She is a regional public affairs specialist for Social Security's administration in Chicago. Vonda, thanks for being here. Good afternoon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us. We always welcome opportunities to talk about this, because just reading this press release about the trust funds can be a little bit alarming, as you were mentioning. So we're always open and welcome to talking about it.
Yeah. Where to begin is the question. Maybe two funds. I don't know if people know how Social Security works. Maybe you can explain that. You've got the Old Age Fund and the Disability Fund. If there's a difference in how those two are funded, I don't know. I'm just wondering, how is the Disability Fund going to keep on going for 75 years while that Old Age Fund looks like every year it's drying up?
Yeah, so we do have two different trust funds. One of them is called the OASI, which stands for Old Age and Survivors Insurance. Old age is what is referring to retirement. I'm not sure I really like that.
Right.
And then the DI trust, I know, right? The older I get, I don't appreciate that. And then the DI is the Disability Trust Fund. So we typically always talk about those trust funds combined. Yeah. And of course, the trustees report talked about the combined trust funds being depleted 1 year earlier, as you mentioned, 2034. Last year, it was 2035. But then it does break it down, as you mentioned, into the individual trust funds. the old age survivors one is projected to be depleted in 2034, whereas the disability trust fund, because they've made some tweaks to that trust fund in the last few years, it's looking solvent, you know, over the projected future. Yeah. You know, we don't worry about that so much. We like to look at the trust funds combined together and what is that projected to be. And as you indicated, it is 1 year earlier. And we don't like to see it go that way. We like to see it the other way.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I've been with this agency since 1991, a long time. And this date always toggles. You know, it's based on assumptions. We're using the actuary's intermediate assumptions. Of course, they do an optimistic one. They do a pessimistic one. We always use the intermediate assumptions. And so they're always going to sway one way or the other, but it hasn't been a drastic change. But we like to talk about it because it's important, because we need Congress to act so that this program continues to be solvent well into the future.
So what's driving the crisis? I know high inflation leads to, you know, raises in Social Security. We're seeing some of the highest in 40 years. Have we borrowed against it too in the past? I mean, how do we get into this situation? I know we also have this situation of demographics where all the baby boomers now are retiring, and as a result of that, there's a greater draw on it. Are less people putting into it now too because we have less births? I mean, there's a lot of factors.
Well, you must have done your homework because you're hitting them all very well. Birth rates is obviously one that contributes to the Social Security ebbs and flows, right? Mm-hmm. I always have a chart that I show when I talk about the history of Social Security, and it just shows how our birth rates, you know, were declining during the war, and then all of a sudden the war is over, everybody's coming home from the war, and we have this tremendous influx called the baby boomer generation. And of course, after a while, that goes down, and now we have about, you know, two births per family, whereas at one point it peaked almost to four births per family. And that, of course, it plays a huge factor when it comes to Social Security. More kids per family means more workers eventually paying into the system. So, you know, tied to that, we have that baby boom generation. We have over 80 million baby boomers that started retiring in 2008. Obviously, that impacts our program. You know, the annual cost is going to continue to grow faster through 2040 because of the baby boomers pulling out of the system versus how many people we have paying into the system. Of course, that's going to plateau off at some point. We also have to talk about, you know, life expectancy. You know, back in 1934 when they started Social Security, I don't think they thought people were going to live much beyond the age of 65.
That's true.
Which is why they safely made the full retirement age 65. Well, you know, we have people, life expectancy for men, you know, it's around 84. Life expectancy for women, we're looking at around 87. That plays a huge role. We have people living into their hundreds now.
Wow.
What does that mean? That means they're pulling from the system for a much longer period of time. So you're right. All of these changes in the economy and the demographics of the country all factor into Social Security.
Yeah, let's follow up on a few of those points because I think they're really important. Then we'll take a few calls. If you're on hold, I'll get you on. If you want to get in, the number's 888-914-9149. Changing demographics. I mean, it's such a great point that you bring up. Life expectancy has really been extended. So what does that mean? If we say, okay, people are no longer passing away in their late 60s or early 70s, but they're living much longer, will we see the raise for full payment, you know, in terms of payout? Is that going to get shifted to 70-something? What do you think we're going to see in terms of somehow meeting those changing demographics? Less money out, you have to pay in longer. How's it going to work? How do you see it playing out?
Well, interestingly, you know, we already made a change back in 1983, and it was a change during the Greenspan Commission to strengthen the financing of Social Security, and it was an increase in the full retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a gradual increase from 65 to 67. And this change took place in 1983, but it didn't affect anyone until the year 2000. And so I always use that as an example of, the kind of changes, not necessarily that change, but that kind of a change where it's real gradual. It doesn't affect one generation. Mm-hmm. It affects multiple generations. So it's a much more gradual change. You know, whether it is, like you indicated in the beginning, an increase in benefits or, you know, a reduction or change in the amount of benefits or who becomes eligible for benefits, just make them gradual so we don't have one generation get hit so hard with those changes.
It's a good point. You got to make them gradual. I just can't imagine. What were they saying? 27% decrease in benefits being paid out or something along those lines?
Well, if we don't make any changes at all,
right?
They're saying, okay, we're no longer capable of paying 100% of the benefits that we owe in 2034. But then, of course, we always have money coming into the system. So we're still capable of paying 80%. But, of course, we're not going to get to that point and say, okay, we're going to cut everybody's benefits 20%.
That would never happen. No, no.
Clearly, that's not going
to
happen.
But I couldn't imagine what it would do to seniors. And there's no politician in the planet that would do something like that, you know, if they wanted a future.
No.
I always try to calm people down, too, when it comes to this issue. We'll find a way to keep Social Security in place. A lot of people depend on it. This is their only source of income for retirement. And,
Absolutely. Absolutely. If they eliminated Social Security, we would have over half of our elderly living in poverty.
Wow, that's
tragic. I don't think we're ready for that to happen.
Well, let's take a few phone calls. Time is my enemy. It goes so quickly here. We'll go to Kathy in Philadelphia. Kathy, hi. You are on the air with Vonda Van Til. Good afternoon. Kathy, go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just wanted to remind everybody that we've also killed over 60 million workers that are, you know, contributing to Social Security. So that's a big problem.
It is, Kathy. Thank you for throwing that on the table, too. We were talking demographics, Vonda, and it's true in that respect. As you know, we used to have this pyramid where you had fewer people on the top and a much larger base feeding into the system. And now we're seeing with abortion, with fertility rates on the decrease. I did a program probably last month or a couple of weeks ago on how sperm count in just the past 46 years has decreased 50%. So if those trends hold going into the future, that gives a lot of pause. There was talk, though, and just back to funding for a second here, if we could get to it. I don't know who proposed it. I don't like the idea at all. If you've paid into Social Security your entire life, I think you should be able to get something out of it. But there were some people that say, hey, if you make X amount of dollars or if your net worth is worth so much, then you might be excluded from it. Are you familiar with that? Who proposed that at some point? It was an idea floated around last time Social Security was under the microscope.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. We don't really track everyone's recommendations for changes to the system because we don't really get involved in that. That is an act of Congress, and whatever they pass, you know, we start educating the public about it. But there are just a plethora of recommendations and suggestions out there, so I wouldn't be surprised if one of them was that. I did want to make a point about the trustees' report. When they're calculating the intermediate assumptions, they are factoring in abortion rates. They're factoring in immigration, both legal and illegal immigration. So all of that is factored in when the trustee is completing the report.
Yeah. Well, as well said, let's go back. We'll take another call or two for you. Michael's in Yorkville, Illinois. Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks so much for taking my call and Rhonda for your help. I'll be quick on this. I started collecting for Social Security January of 2024, and my wife won't collect until July of 2024, and I've heard some of the information, so I just want clarity. Can I take my full Social Security in January 2024 and get part of hers or all of hers until she retires in clicks?
Well, you are required to file for your own Social Security before we will look into additional spouse's benefits. And the only way you can get additional on your spouse's record is if your own is less than half of theirs.
If
the only exception to that would
be,
the only exception to what I just said is if you were born before January 2nd, 1954.
Yep. No, I was born on New Year's Day, 1957.
Yeah. So that means you have to file for your own retirement and you can't get additional on your spouse's record unless your own is less than half of your spouse's.
Okay.
Okay, if mine is less than half of hers, that's the only way. Okay, that's great. Thanks so much. Yep.
Michael, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
God bless. Happy Easter.
Yeah, you too. I appreciate that. Happy Easter. Hey, you know, a lot of people want to get in here, right? Just a couple more thoughts that have popped into my head I just want to indulge in. There are some people saying that the government should invest Social Security funds in the stock market. I don't know how wise that is. And other people propose maybe privatizing it. That's totally unlikely. Both of those scenarios, I'm assuming?
Well, again, those have all been recommendations or suggestions talked about. You know, I really can't say if any or some of them would be passed. If they are, we will educate the public about them. I mean, right now, we are required to invest in special issues, which are like bonds. Yeah. Which is the safest investment there is, and then we redeem the number of bonds that we need each month to pay our beneficiaries, and then the remainder collects interest. That's how it is today.
All right, Mary, in Whittier, California, good afternoon. You're on the air with Vonda Ventel.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I would propose that when the IRA retirement accounts are withdrawn, that they are taxed. That tax money go to fund the Social Security. And I would also propose that if that don't happen, immediately it could be such where the tax owed on IRA withdrawals can go into a personal fund of the owner of the IRA to fund medical expenses instead of being taxed by the government, and who knows where it goes.
All right, Mary, thanks for the idea. Again, Vonda, I don't know if you'd even respond to that. I know it's another proposal, another theory that's out there.
You know what I tell people?
Yeah.
Hey, that's awesome that you guys have ideas. Let your congressman know, because they're the ones that make things happen.
Yeah. Mary in Henderson, Nevada, thank you for joining us. Good afternoon.
Hi, I like that lady's idea about the medical, because I don't know if people know this, and I certainly didn't know it when I retired, and nobody gave me a class on it. But the government will take part of your Social Security if you make over a certain amount of money. Now, I'm in no way wealthy, and they've taken as much as $400 out of my Social Security. So you depend on Social Security, and then after the fact, you find out that they're going to take money out of your Social Security to fund what used to be, it was during Obama's administration, and it was to fund medical. So that's a problem. That's a problem. Nobody expects that you plan for Social Security. You don't expect that somebody's going to reduce it to pay for medical. That should be separate. It should be a separate issue with the government, not out of my Social Security check. The other thing is, there's a lot of people that haven't put into the program that take out of Social Security, and it was never designed that way. It was supposed to be self-sufficient. Yeah. And those are my comments.
Thank you very much. Vonda, I'll let you respond. I'm curious, especially to the latter question she threw out.
Well, so you have to work and pay into the Social Security system in order to be able to collect a benefit on your own record. So if I never worked and paid in, I'm not going to get retirement. I'm not going to get disability. Maybe I can get a spousal benefit on my spouse's record, or a divorced spouse's benefit if I've been married for 10 years or more prior to the divorce. Or maybe I can get a survivor benefit if my spouse or ex-spouse passed away. But I can't get anything on my own record if I haven't worked and paid into the system. I can't get anything on my spouse's record unless they worked and paid into the system. So you have to become insured in order to be eligible, or in order for your family to be eligible on your record.
Well, and again, I don't know how this works.
Yeah, go ahead.
How does it work with a spouse? If your spouse is a stay-at-home spouse their entire life, you only have one source of Social Security. It'd be the working spouse, or do they get something? That spouse get something? How does it work?
So, you know, let's say I stayed home and took care of the kids my whole life, and I didn't work outside the home. I don't have the 40 credits, which you need to get Social Security retirement, but I am married.
Right.
So once my spouse files for Social Security retirement benefits, I then can file for spouse's benefits on my spouse's record as long as I am 62 or older. and I can get up to 50% of his full retirement amount, and then that is reduced if I file before my full retirement age. But again, I have to wait for my spouse to file, right, and my benefit amount is based on how much my spouse has worked and paid into the system.
So you get, so the spouse gets theirs, and then the other spouse gets 50% of that if they go to the banks.
Yep.
And it, what if the primary spouse dies who earned the money? That person then gets that spouse's full benefit?
Yep. If you're a widow or a widower, you get 100% of what the deceased was getting at the time of their death if you are full retirement age when you file for the widow or widower's benefit.
Interesting. All right. My guest today, Vonda Vantell, we only have a few moments with her. I'll try to grab a few more calls. I know a lot of people want to talk with you, Vonda. She's the Regional Public Affairs mm-hmm. Specialist for the Social Security Administration out of Chicago. And let's go to Albitha in Austin, Texas. Hi, Albitha.
Hi, Drew. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling because I constantly receive in the mail from a national committee to preserve Social Security and Medicare, like certificates for me if I donate a certain amount monthly to have our congressmen defend us in not letting the Social Security disappear.
Right.
And I ask people about this, you know, should I be paying my congressmen that
right.
also are receiving a salary
right.
to be in Congress and to defend us? Or should I ignore this totally? Is this for real or what?
That's a great question. Go ahead, Vonda, I'll let you respond.
Well, it is legit. I mean, they are asking you to give them money,
yeah.
but you are correct. You can just write your congressman, congresswoman, with any suggestions or issues that you might have with a federal agency that you're working with.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't really want to say anything on behalf of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare,
right.
but I do know that they have those mailings out there and are asking for your support.
Isn't Social Security often used, though, as a political tool of some sort or a carrot to get people to vote certain ways? Like, quite often, I think a lot of seniors are... There are certain candidates that come out and say, this guy, if you vote for him, he's going to take away your Social Security or he's going to lower your benefits if this happens. That's how much truth is in that? I mean, that's not really the case, is it?
Well, I mean, I think they know what scares voters.
Yeah.
And I think they know what a hot potato is out there. So they're going to throw it out there.
Yeah.
You know, our congressmen and women are the ones who can change the law. They're the ones who can make Social Security solvent well into the future. So they're the ones that make the changes. So when someone feels strongly about it or has this great idea, I'm not kidding when I say let your congressional reps know, because that's where,
yeah.
you know, that's where it happens. So
yeah.
it is important to always let them know how you're feeling and where you want this program to go.
If you're just joining me, we're talking about the latest news. Social Security is expected to run short of cash by 2033, at least that's what is being reported. I actually saw 2031 somewhere. I don't know where that was. But if you got a question, comment, we're talking right now with Vonda Vantell about it. And I want you to be at peace. I don't think Social Security is going to go anywhere. I don't see an immediate cut in it. I do see Vonda perhaps at some point in the future raising that age. But Jerry's got an idea as well. He's in Naperville, Illinois, and he wants to join the conversation. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, all. Yeah, just a quick question. It seems like such a no-brainer that the fix to Social Security would be to just eliminate the income cap for people donating or, you know, putting money into Social Security. What is it now? Like if you make... After you make $130,000 or something like that, they don't take Social Security out of your paycheck, and which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, because
yeah.
those folks making a whole ton of money yeah. aren't even putting into it after it hit a certain point.
Yeah, that keeps going up every year, doesn't it, Vonda? So it was 120 something, 130. I don't know whether it's up to 140 something now. His
yeah.
idea that let's remove the cap. If you earn money, no matter what you earn, you continue to have Social Security taken mm-hmm. from it. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a pretty popular one that comes up quite often when I go out and do presentations. The cap is actually $160,200 in 2023.
Wow.
So what that means
I jumped.
Is once somebody makes $160,200, they no longer have to pay the 6.2% Social Security tax. They still pay the 1.45% Medicare tax on every dime they make, but that 6.2% FICA tax stops. So a lot of people, you know, say, hey, let's just not have that maximum taxable earnings. Let's make everybody pay Social Security on every dime they make, which is obviously a suggestion, a possibility, but we also have to remember that our dollar amount that we get every month is based on how much we have worked and made over our highest 35 years. So if we're going to use one's actual earnings, some individuals' monthly dollar amounts could be extremely large.
That's true.
Based on how much they're making.
Yeah, if you make millions, how does that work, right? So there's a cap on the max you can make, right? Off of Social Security?
Oh, yes, yes. So because there's a maximum that you pay in, there's also a maximum Social Security benefit,
right,
which, you know, limits makes how much sense we have to pay. This year, it's $3,627. So we have to think about that as well.
You know, how do they determine the raise? Because, you know, if Jerry had called in and thought it was $130,000, I thought it was about $140,000, $150,000. How do they determine the bump every year?
Well, those types of changes come along with our cost of living announcements.
Oh, wow.
So everything is directly tied to the consumer price index. And as you know, we had a huge cost of living increase in 2023, the largest since, I think 1981.
40 years, yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was 8.7%. So, you know, with that comes a lot of the other changes, you know, how much you're allowed to make while you're getting benefits and the maximum taxable earnings, all of those go up as well.
Well, I'll tell you, Vonda, I'll have to have you back. I know we only have so much time today. A lot of people have a ton of questions, and we'll have to revisit this issue again. I appreciate you giving us some clarity. I'm just delighted to have you here.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure.
We'll talk soon,
Absolutely.
Okay?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hey, before I let you go, very quickly, if people need more information on Social Security, what's the best place to go?
Go to ssa.gov, which is a wonderful government website. Cool. We also have a national toll-free number, 1-800-772-1213. And there's reps there from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. on business days.
That's ssa.gov as well. I'll be right back. Stay with me. Hey, looking for a new job? How about one that offers opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Earlier this afternoon, Donald Trump was arraigned on a New York Supreme Court indictment, returned by a Manhattan grand jury, on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in the first degree. Under New York State law, it is a felony to falsify business records with intent to defraud and an intent to conceal another crime. That is exactly what this case is about. 34 false statements made to cover up other crimes. These are felony crimes in New York State. No matter who you are, we cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
That is the prosecutor, Manhattan prosecutor Alvin Bragg, right after Donald Trump had turned himself in today. And look, I was just talking to my next guest, James Harrison, who's going to be joining me in a few moments. He says, pretty much a one-note day today, isn't it? I mean, it's all Donald Trump. And as you probably know, he had to go to Manhattan. He was in a courtroom this afternoon, charged 34 felony counts for falsifying business records in the first degree. I'm not quite sure what that means. James will be joining me. I can get his take on that. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not this is politically motivated and what will come of this. This could be a big nothing burger. Go away, right? The president pled not guilty to each of those 34 counts. That's not unusual for him. He hired one of the best attorneys he could, too. And he didn't have much to say. Some people thought prior to walking in or afterwards, he would say something. Of course, there'll be an address later today. But he walked into court, out of court. There were helicopter coverage. There was cameras positioned everywhere. Everybody was abuzz. The whole proceeding took about an hour. And when it was all done, he was then taken back to the airport and flew on his private jet back to Mar-a-Lago. The Associated Press was reporting that the next hearing will not be until December. December 4th. That's what, 8 months from now, right? So I don't know if this is an indication of what kind of judge he's facing, but the AP reported that the judge warned him to refrain from rhetoric that could inflame or cause civil unrest. I think they're concerned maybe there'll be some rioting as a result of it. But look, if he's convicted of all those felonies, he'd be facing a maximum of 3 years in jail. And as you heard earlier, this involves just paying out $130,000 in hush money to Stormy Daniels. She was a porn actress. And then $150,000 to a Playboy model named Karen McDougal over alleged affairs. And again, I want to be very clear, in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty. And Trump has denied the charges. Okay, he has denied them. The charges aren't really over that, but over whether or not Trump covered the payments up as legal expenses to his then lawyer, Michael Cohen. I'm really curious when I get off the air a little bit later today to just see how the multitude of media outlets out there are going to cover this. How biased, how unbiased, how giddy some are going to be. This isn't the only legal proceeding that he's got going against him either. Business Insider was reporting that there was a state prosecutor in Georgia who is weighing if Trump tried to overturn the 2020 election results in that state. And the Justice Department, they're looking into the 2020 election as well as Trump's possible mishandling of classified documents. I figure if they do that to him, they're going to have to do it to President Biden too. But we'll see what comes of this. Again, is it politically motivated? Is it an attempt to derail him? He is running for president once again. There was even, believe it or not, and I've got to look into this in greater detail, there was actually a rape claim against the former president that's going to be heard this month. So a lot of claims. Back in December, Trump's real estate company, it was convicted in state court in Manhattan for a payroll tax dodge scheme. It resulted in about, I think the fine was $1.5 million, $1.6 million. Pretty big number. But Stormy Daniels, who was at the center of this case, she now owes Trump $122,000 in legal fees over another case, which she lost. That's according to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Are you with me or is your head spinning right now, right? I mean, I don't know how. I'd have a heart attack if I was in that situation. I mean, I don't know how you do it, right? It's like a whirlwind. I'm joined today by somebody who can help us see through the storm here and really discern what's ultimately happening. And that is New York Times bestselling author, commentator, news analyst, and law professor, James Herson. You can check him out at Newsmax.com. He writes the Left Coast Report there. And I always encourage you to follow him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is easy to remember, @TheJimJams. Jim, good to have you back. Thanks for joining me.
It's always great to be with you, Drew. This happens to be a dark day historically in our history. We know it's unprecedented. It never happened before that someone, a former president, was actually brought into a criminal court and arraigned like this. And there's good reason why it hasn't happened and why it's something that we avoided. You know, there was talk about doing this to Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. and but decided not to for various reasons. It's something, you know, former presidents have a special status in our country, are important as more than just individuals. They're symbols of our country. And I even find it distasteful to let people know exactly where our presidents are located at a specific time, right, because we know that presidential lives are always in danger and that we've had presidents have their lives taken. So this whole thing should be distasteful. Unfortunately, there are people who are blinded by their political lenses and their hatred for the man, which has been ginned up by segments of the media now for years. But you have to admit one thing. This man is the most investigated man in the history of our country, just as an individual. But as a president, you know, we're talking about the Mueller investigation. We're talking about two attempted impeachments, attempted to convict him over impeachments, throw him out of office. all of those issues just dropped, and all of a sudden a case that's based on events from 2017 is brought in by a Soros-funded prosecutor who campaigned taking office based on what he perceived as Trump hatred. He campaigned on doing just this, on getting Donald Trump. And this is a DA who refuses to prosecute felonies throughout his state, but now is taking a non-crime and trying to conflate it into a felony. And we see analysts from all across the political spectrum, all kinds of legal analysts looking at this and calling it flimsy. As a matter of fact, I cannot find a legal analyst who can put together an argument that Alvin Bragg's indictment of former President Trump is somehow a solid case. It is actually a pathetic case, and that's why the Federal Election Commission dropped it. The Federal Department of Justice dropped it. Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance, dropped it. And Alvin Bragg himself dropped the case and decided it was too flimsy. So the question is, what changed? And I think we can answer that question by what the prosecutors asked for in terms of the trial date. Yeah. They asked the judge to set the trial for January of 2024. Wow. Now, that date has tremendous political significance. Yeah. That's the kickoff of the primary season. And so if a candidate was in a trial where they had to be in a courtroom in Manhattan every day and couldn't campaign, then in theory, they'd be hampered in terms of being able to seek the Republican nomination. And the thing that makes this a politically motivated case is that there's always been an understanding. We heard a lot of talk about prosecutorial discretion. We hear that all the time, especially from Soros-funded prosecutors. Well, the fact is that prosecutorial discretion has said, hey, we're not going to go after someone who is a potential candidate during an election season. Well, we're in the preseason, if you will, for the 2024 primary. The polls show that Donald Trump is the clear front runner for the Republican nomination. So the idea of bringing him in for a non-crime, essentially, and trying to strap him down this way, it's truly a disgrace. Yeah. And from a legal point of view, the indictment itself is extremely deficient in this regard, Drew. It fails to state the underlying crime that President Trump's bookkeeping was supposed to cover up.
Right.
So the way it works is they're bootstrapping.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, if there's a bookkeeping, fraudulent bookkeeping type case, white collar case, it's a misdemeanor. If it's a misdemeanor, it's too late. The statute of limitations has expired.
Yeah.
So they have to make it a felony. They can only make it a felony if the bookkeeping fraud was to cover up another crime. So they claim that this payment to Stormy Daniels is a federal election crime, and that will, change the statute of limitations. And this is the bootstrapping that's occurring, and that's how they're doing this. But the fact is that particular case is just really flimsy.
Yeah, Professor. Professor Hirschman, hold the thought. I've got to take a short pause here. When we come back, we can talk more, okay? We'll pick it up. I only have about 10 minutes left. If you want to join the conversation, I'll open the phones when I return. The number's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Giving you the latest on, what's happening with our president. He will be addressing the country later tonight. He's going to deliver remarks from Mar-a-Lago, and we'll bring you up to speed on that as well. Stay with us. Our conversation continues right after this.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
All the news and issues now that are happening now.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, hey, thanks for joining us. I'll grab a few of your calls. You can get in at 888-914-9149. The president will be delivering remarks from Mar-a-Lago tonight. He took off right after being in that Manhattan courtroom. And we'll see what he's got to say. You heard from Prosecutor Alvin Bragg. We'll see what the president has got to say next. My guest today, James Herson. I invited him to stop by to give us some perspective. As I said, he's a professor of law. He's a very gifted journalist, and it's just a delight to have him here with us today. You can check him out at his website, jamesherson.com, or at the Jim Jams. And the last name is H-I-R-S-E-N, H-I-R-S-E-N. And James, let's grab a call or two, okay, and then we can talk a little bit more as well. San Jose, California is on deck. Peter, good afternoon. You are on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my comment was, is I have to really question the motivation of the defenders of Donald Trump in this, in that it seems like because he was able to put Supreme Court justices on the bench that overruled Roe v. Wade, a lot of people are giving him a free pass on everything else just for the sake of that. I think that's a wrong approach.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I'll let James respond. We can talk about it. Do you see it that way, James?
Sure, of course not. And I appreciate Peter, you know, making his voice heard and giving a comment. But I want to say this. The Constitution requires due process of law. This is not a matter of giving Donald Trump or any individual a pass. And if due process is made up of two components. The first is notice. So that means that if you're charged with a crime, it has to be very clear to you what the crime is. The second component is an opportunity to be heard, an opportunity to defend oneself. That's why we always have the presumption of innocence, innocent until proven guilty. And that's why we seek fair trials. It's really a biblical concept that we receive as Americans from the British common law. Now, if the underlying crime is in this indictment is either ambiguous or it's unstated, then it becomes highly questionable whether the defendant can mount an adequate defense. How can you defend yourself from a crime when you don't know what it is? They left that out of the indictment, and they based the indictment on a law that is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. When there's ambiguity in the law, then that relates to the same thing. How can you defend yourself from a law that is ambiguous? So this will be appealed. The defense lawyers will ultimately file a motion to dismiss. They will make these arguments. It may go up to the very Supreme Court that Peter called to talk about. They may make this decision, but it may be based upon the federal constitution, the supreme law of the land, which has not been alluded to by the prosecution and has been ignored in the indictment itself on its face. Because as I said, there are these 34 counts, but left out of the indictment. And that question was asked of Alvin Bragg. What is the underlying crime that you allege that President Trump covered up? And he said, well, I don't have to put it in there. The law does not require it to be in there. And the Constitution does. And that's just one of many weaknesses here. But that's a big, big weakness. and that's ground for a motion to dismiss.
Peter, thank you. I appreciate the call and sharing your perspective there. Speaking of Bragg, before I jump back to the phones, I had heard somewhere that he had reduced 50% of the felonies that came across his desk to misdemeanors. You wonder how he views whether there is special, adversity or animosity towards the president. He did run on going after Donald Trump after all, and he's just fulfilling that campaign promise. You wonder what is the motivator behind this. Irene, good afternoon. Thanks for listening to us in Chicago. You're on the air. Irene, go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you. First of all, the fact that Bragg had run on the fact that he was going to get Donald Trump before any of this happened is suspicious. The fact that this seems to me, I'm not a law expert, but a manufactured crime. They had to do all this finagling and getting all this stuff just to make a case out of him. And the judge that's going to be presiding hates him and has convicted others of crimes. And let's not forget the witch hunts with Michael Flynn and everybody else that's been associated with Trump that has been unjustly prosecuted, if you will, even by the court of public opinion. And what about Hillary and her emails? And what about other presidents like, you know, Bush and the Bill Clinton, for example? Why is it only Donald Trump? So all these people that say things like, oh, he gets away with stuff. Well, like what? I mean, I don't understand. I think this is something bigger. It makes me question what exactly are they afraid that he's blocking and not allowing to get into motion. I feel that Christianity is under attack. Law and order is under attack. We don't agree with the Democrats or certain left-wing people, and all of a sudden we all have to cower down in the United States of America. The whole thing sounds very peculiar, and so is the timing.
Irene, thank you for your call. Let me hold you on that point because we only have a few moments left. A lot of people now want to get in to talk to James, but James, I'll let you respond.
Sure, I may. I really appreciate Irene's comment because what it reflects is something that a lot of people are feeling. They're disillusioned with our legal system because they watch some people seem to be getting prosecuted and persecuted, and particularly Donald Trump, and others given a pass. It's not coincidental to me that the committees in the House had just recently uncovered hard evidence of $1 million moving from China to members of the family of Joe Biden. That just happened right before the indictment, which wiped it off the pages of the press. So this creates something that's really actually dangerous in the country. That is, people are losing faith in the criminal justice system, in law enforcement, and to a great extent, it has to do with prosecutors like Mr. Bragg, who are placed there by entities that are funded by George Soros and others, and who, instead of doing their job, superimpose a so-called progressive political philosophy and fail to do the job necessary to protect the citizens of our major cities in this country. It's happening in San Francisco, Los Angeles, St. Louis, and of course Manhattan. And this is part of people feeling that lack of faith in our institutions, and it's tragic.
James, I got to leave it right there. Thank you for your time. My apologies to everyone on hold. James Herson is a New York Times best-selling author. Check him out at the Left Coast Report and follow him on Twitter at the Jim Jams. Kale Clark is coming straight up. Stay tuned.